This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Insurance Commissioner Jim Donilon. He'll talk about insurance issues and what's going on with the Affordable Care Act, flood insurance, homeowners insurance, and much more. Jim Donilon with us for much of the hour. We'll also hear from John Treen, longtime Republican politico and brother of the late former Governor David Treen. John Treen, 25 years ago, lost a 227-vote race to David Duke in Duke's only electoral victory in District 81 for the Louisiana House of Representatives. John Treen will remember that race, and he'll talk about the entry of David Vitter into the Louisiana governor's race. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our guest is Insurance Commissioner Jim Donilon. Come next month, he'll have been on the job for 8 years as Louisiana's Insurance Commissioner, and it's been a busy time, and we have much to discuss with him. And he has quite a personal story to tell. We'll talk, of course, about the Affordable Care Act, but you are a prostate cancer survivor. How is that going?
It's going well, Jim. I was not happy to get the diagnosis about 2 years ago, and have been treating it proactively since. My doctor, bless his heart, was really persistent in testing me for two reasons. For several years, I had an elevated PSA reading. And my father died of prostate cancer, although at age 85, it had first appeared for him at 80, and the protocol back then included, and he opted to do a year's radiation treatment, and at the end of the year at age 81, they said, you're cured, something else will kill you, but you can say fortunately, unfortunately, because he ended up dying in an Alzheimer's condition or state from the recurrence of the prostate cancer, but he had lasted for 4 years, and after the quote cure, and they probably used New York Life's life expectancy chart and said this man will not be here but for another couple years and will therefore not succumb to prostate cancer, and that was incorrect. All of that to say, with a family history, that's one of the strongest indicators. And I have been very public in discussing my condition and recurrence and subsequent radiation treatment this fall. And the good health that I'm enjoying, despite that ongoing concern and treatment, for the purpose of telling folks, be proactive, do test, know your family history, and monitor. It's a very easy thing to do because all it takes is a little vial of blood to be tested at a lab to see if you actually have an elevated PSA, which if you do, seek the help and treatment of a urologist. And they will determine whether they need to do biopsies or not. Had to do three times me, but three. Three different times. I did one time, they put me under anesthesia in a hospital, and instead of the usual dozen plugs, they did two dozen and still didn't find it. But a lobbyist friend of mine at the state capitol in his 40s was recently diagnosed during a routine exam with his internist. She picked it up, sent him to a urologist who did a biopsy, and first biopsy they found the cancer. So it's treatable, it's curable, and it's as prevalent in males, mostly older guys like me, but sometimes in their 40s. It's as prevalent in males as breast cancer is in females, the difference being with breast cancer, it's a young woman's disease and therefore more devastating than prostate, but prostate is quite serious, but quite manageable.
What was your PSA reading?
I'm trying to remember. Seems like it was 4, 5, and that's an interesting question because that was always high, elevated, I guess is the word they'd use, but not dispositive. And so one of the protocols early on with an elevated PSA is to put you on an antibiotic that is targeted at prostate infections because if there's an infection mm-hmm. in that area, it will elevate your PSA. So they did that for 6 months and then did that third and biopsy that turned up the positive outcome that led to the rest of the treatment. But I'd say it was in the 4-5 range, not the 7-8 range. If you're in the 7-8 range, you need to get to your urologist post-haste.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we're talking about health care, you've been dealing a lot with that on your job. The
Indeed.
Affordable Care Act came into being officially on, I think, October 1st.
That's correct.
So we're, what, 3-4 months into this endeavor. How's it going?
Oh, it's been a challenge. And when the president made his announcement in November that he was going to give the states the option to extend for another year policies that were being discontinued for not meeting the minimum standards of the Affordable Care Act for a qualified health plan, that led to more discussion, confusion, if you will. And interestingly, Jim, it was for the most part Republican states like my own that took him up on his offer, and for the most part Democrat states like Washington that said no to allowing companies to extend those unqualified or non-qualified plans for another year. So that was just the most recent wrinkle. When you say it went into effect October 1st, that is when people were able to start signing up. They had to have, quote unquote, coverage in place by January 1st to be qualified to avoid the penalty. And they have now until March 31st to get that coverage in place and prevent the $95 or 1% of their income for 2014 penalty that's included in the Affordable Care Act for individuals who go uninsured.
297-5633 for Jim Donilon. What's the biggest question you have regarding the Obamacare or Affordable Care Act?
The most often asked question is how do I go about getting coverage, and that's a pretty straightforward answer. You can do it on the website, which I'm happy to report is finally functioning more efficiently, and users are able to access it and get coverage through it, but today, we get about 200 calls a week at the department with questions about the Affordable Care Act. The most often heard question today is, I signed up, but I went to the doctor or hospital or some healthcare provider, and they didn't have me shown as having health insurance. Why? What's the problem? And the problem is the policyholder didn't pay their premium yet. And so you have to not only sign up, but you also have to send your premium in. And so we're working with those policyholders and with the companies to make sure that the individuals know that they have to pay their premium, how much it is, send it in, where to send it, and get those one-at-a-time issues for policyholders addressed.
What's the biggest unforeseen challenge that you have encountered?
Cost. I'd say solvency right behind that. But what will the cost be for all the benefits that are being provided under the Affordable Care Act. Two, right off the top, are guarantee issue, which means everybody, no matter how sick, have to be written when an application is filled out. And that price for that very sick person, perhaps older person, but not yet Medicare eligible person, that price is the same as a healthy and no more than three times a very young, very healthy policyholder. And if we end up with the system having an overly large number of older, sick policyholders and not enough younger, healthy to balance, to spread that risk across, then prices will skyrocket, not this year, but next year, when those loss experiences are factored in. And that theoretically could lead to a death spiral, as we call it in the insurance industry, where that gets worse and worse, prices go higher and higher, and then everybody starts dropping out.
877-217-5757, wherever you are, for Insurance Commissioner Jim Donilon. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Bruce and Walden. Bruce, you're on the air with Commissioner Donilon.
Hello, gentlemen. The Advocate had a terrific editorial on Medicaid expansion, by the way, yesterday. But my question is, the Institute of Medicine estimates that 697 people a year die in Louisiana because they don't have medical insurance. And I'm wondering if the commissioner has any thoughts about that.
Thank you. And this morning's Times Picayune has an editorial again urging the governor to accept the expansion of Medicaid. That's not my decision. It is the governor's decision. It's the governor's decision in all 50 states, and half of the states have decided not to do it. Texas decided not to do it, for example. We are one of the, I guess, top 10, maybe even top 5 states for a percent of our population uninsured. Historically, it's always been estimated that we have about 20% of our population uninsured. That means not only do they not have private insurance, they don't have private insurance or Medicare or Medicaid. And this, of course, was an opportunity for 3 years to expand those roles, with the federal government committing for 3 years to provide 90% to be matched by 10% from the states for that expansion. The problem the governor has, and he points to all the time, and half the governors are in agreement with him across the country, 3 years from now, when the federal government pulls the plug, as they tend to do with new federal programs, they make it very user-friendly for the states to join in to the program, but then once you're in, they take that 90-10 and reduce it to 70-30. And that 30% additional cost for the state, our governor says the state can't afford three years from now. So there are, within the Affordable Care Act, provisions to allow the working poor, quote-unquote, those between 100 and 400% of the federal poverty level to get subsidies. For an individual, that means you can be making up to $43,000 a year and get a subsidy on your private health insurance by accessing it through the marketplace or exchange, as it used to be called. For a family of four, that goes up to $95,000 per year in income for that family. Typically, that would be a firefighter and a school teacher, perhaps, and two children. So there are subsidies, and hopefully that will address that 700 per year death rate that results from our large uninsured population. But that decision lies exclusively with Governor Jindal.
297-5633. We'll take a short break and return with Commissioner Donilon. What happens after those 3 years?
No one knows. And that's why so many governors are reluctant. In our state, if you accept the expansion, something between 40 and 45% of the state's population would be Medicaid eligible.
We'll return with Commissioner Jim Donilon after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Jim Donilon with us. Lloyd in North Baton Rouge. Good morning, Lloyd. You're on the air with Commissioner Donilon.
Good morning, Commissioner. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, sir.
Question, what do you recommend a person do that has applied through the marketplace, that had a letter from the marketplace dated January 3rd, given a $285 subsidy, and then receiving another letter on January 9th, only receiving $145, with two different application numbers, but only one application submitted. And then the insurance company only observing the lower subsidy. Nothing changed. The application didn't change, just two letters with two different numbers.
I would recommend that that person call us at 1-800-259-5300 and okay. fill out a very short complaint form. We just need information like your name, address, Social Security number, policy form, then the name of the insurer, because we have a contact person with all the health insurers in the state, and we'll address that on your behalf.
1-800-259-5300.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Not
Thank you, Lloyd. David in Sherwood Forest. David, you're on the air with Commissioner Donilon.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a comment. As far as I know, in the 100 or so articles about Medicaid expansion that I've read, the information is incorrect. It was stated that, from what I've heard, the first 3 years, the federal government provides 100% match. The states are at 0%. And over 10 years, it goes down to 90% only in the 10th year. So it's our Louisiana Legislative Fiscal Office itself, a nonpartisan office, showed a study that the state would save over $500 million over 10 years. So
All right.
Well, I'm happy to stand corrected. If that is the case, I have no doubt but that the Legislative Fiscal Office is nonpartisan and objective. I have no quarrel with that. I served there for 19 years and saw that firsthand. My understanding was the commitment was 90-10 for 3 years. Your information may be better than mine because, frankly, it's not my issue. It's the governor's issue, and us insurance commissioners are not party to that discussion.
Okay. Charles on North Foster. Good morning, Charles. You're on with Commissioner Donilon. We lost Charles. 297-5633 is your number, and Jim Donilon is here to take questions about all kinds of insurance. And usually in previous years, you would be talking about car insurance or homeowners insurance. Those issues haven't gone away, have they?
Not at all. In fact, from that which we do have jurisdiction over, which is the private insurance market that we regulate, auto insurance is our biggest challenge. And yesterday I met with the representatives of the Louisiana Motor Transport Association, the truckers, and they are in crisis mode over the cost of trucking insurance to drive commercial vehicles on the highways and byways in our state. It's a real challenge for us, has been for as long as I've been involved. Louisiana's always been one of the top 10 most expensive states for auto insurance. The rest of the country has seen decreases over the past 5 years. Ours have been flat until 2 years ago. We were seeing 1% per year increases, but other states were seeing decreases that were sending us up the charts to the top of the top of the list.
Well, a few days ago, as January 15th, the House approved a spending bill that includes a flood insurance delay. What does this mean for Louisiana?
Well, it's good news. Not as much good news as we had hoped for and are still hoping for. And that relief would come in the form of the Menendez bill that Senator Menendez, I think is his name, of New Jersey, together with both of our U.S. senators, Vitter, a Republican, and Landrieu, a Democrat, are totally supportive of, that would put a freeze on the rate increases called for by the Biggert Waters Reauthorization and Reform Bill passed a year and a half ago after several years of kicking the can down the road by Congress in the flood insurance arena. Flood insurance started in the 60s, has been reauthorized every 5 years, as is the norm in Washington, for TRIA, the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, that came about after the attacks of 9/11 and has been reauthorized every 5 years, as the flood insurance program had been reauthorized every 5 years until 3 years ago when it expired and they did 30-day, 60-day, 180-day extensions and retroactively put folks back in coverage that had lapsed while the program was not reauthorized. And that was creating chaos in the real estate market nationwide, so that ultimately a compromise was forged in Congress between the fiscal hawks and those who were pro-flood insurance program, a program that is $25 billion in debt as we speak, to put it on a five-year glide path to actuarially sound rates. And what ended up being the unintended consequence of that is for thousands of properties in primarily coastal Louisiana, they were rendered worthless because they couldn't get financing. The cost of keeping flood insurance in place became prohibitive. And the relief that was granted by Congressman Cassidy's effort in the recent budget bill will help those folks who have been grandfathered into protection for residential property, but not commercial property and not property that's sold retroactive back to July 1 of 2013, 12 or 13, I forget the effective date. But those properties are subject to the new changes contained in Biggert Waters, and they are substantial. But those residential properties that have been grandfathered will be continued to be protected for one more year while the Senate bill makes its way to the floor for a vote.
This time of year, you're reminding our citizens about citizen rebates. Who's eligible and how can they claim them?
Every property insurance policyholder, commercial as well as residential, gets assessed 4% every year to continue to amortize the $1.2 billion bond issue that was necessary to finish paying off the Katrina claims that Citizens incurred in 2005, paying them off in 2006. There's $230 million on the table as we speak, Jim, that has gone unclaimed for the years 2010, 2011, 2012, and 2013. That for 29 and 28 has prescribed, and about $100 million has reverted back to the state treasury that was left unclaimed by property owners statewide. It's amazing, but historically, year in and year out, 53% of the now about $90 million a year that we assess goes unclaimed, and you have 4 years to go back and do it. It's very easy to do. I take mine on my state income tax return as a dollar-for-dollar credit against my assessment, or, as my mother does when my brother fills out her tax return, he submits she owes no state income tax, so he submits one of these four-line, very short forms, name, address, policy number, amount of your rebate, attaches her deck page for her State Farm homeowner's policy, and she gets a check back in the mail in a week or two from the Department of Revenue. It's very user-friendly, very easy, and every time someone like yourself makes airtime available for me to spread this word, I get stopped on the street and someone says, gee, thanks, I didn't know about that.
There you go.
And I do it, as you said, twice a year, every year, tax time, because it's on people's minds, it's relevant, and at the end of the year to try and alert people that yet another year is going to prescribe and you're going to lose one-fourth of what you're entitled to recoup if you haven't been getting it.
That's almost a quarter of $1 billion.
On the table.
On the table.
And $100 million gone back to the general fund. And every year, it's about $50 million that goes unclaimed.
HB in Denham Springs. Hi, HB. You're on the air with Jim Donilon.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Donilon, this is a two-part question. The number one question is, do you know what the average cost per square foot of the average 1,800-square-foot home, brick, basically in the metro area of Baton Rouge? And the second part of the question is, why is there such a major difference in the replacement cost that insurance companies put on the policyholder?
I can answer the second one. The first one, I do not know what the average cost of a 1,700-square-foot home in Baton Rouge is. But the difference between appraised value and replacement cost is easy to explain. And one is it includes land, which you don't insure. But the other is the rest of the total package, the total home, is dependent upon supply and demand in the real estate market. And it can become higher than the replacement cost, which is based upon what the construction industry would charge. Pick a number, and it's not just picked a number. It's contained in computer programs that are used nationwide to and vary from one area to another, more expensive in New York, probably cheaper in Mississippi than in Baton Rouge. But whatever the construction cost for your type of construction in your home per square foot, not to include the lot, and to replace it. Had that experience myself. I built my house in 1975, and we had a tree fall on our roof in Katrina, and that brought to my wife's attention, who handled our claim, that we had a 2% named storm deductible applicable to our then $220,000 of insured value. Well, I shopped around, changed my insurance, saved a bunch of money by doing that, changing from a major national carrier to one of the new regional carriers that came to our state after Katrina, and initially for a year saved $600 a month. For the last two, I've been saving $400 a month by making that change. But both of those companies, using the Marshall Swift database, put my replacement cost for my home at now $460,000 versus the $220,000 they had it on the books for in 2005. So that's how it works. That's how you can appeal that if you think it's exorbitant. And in fact, we have complaints pending in our office from folks who are not happy with what their insurer has their replacement costs pegged at for their home today.
We have just a few more moments with Commissioner Donilon, so please ask one question and make it as brief as possible. Paul in Opelousas, you're on the air with Jim Donilon.
Yes, sir, Commissioner. My name is Paul from Opelousas. We have an elderly community in our church. A lot of elderly people are using life insurance as burial insurance. What is better for them in that usage?
All right.
Whole life or term, you were going to ask, I do believe. And you need to talk to an agent about that. But term is much more affordable, less pricey. Life is an investment product that you need to compare with other investment opportunities such as bonds and stocks that may offer a better return.
Charles on North Foster. Hello, Charles. You're on with Jim Donilon.
All right, we'll try this again. Commissioner, you stated that the government starts big plans and pulls out after a while. Is there a plan that you know of in Louisiana that would cover the more than 400,000 citizens without health insurance? And do you support it?
I do not know of a plan. The state is not in a position to afford to be able to provide Medicaid-level health insurance. They don't truly fund the current level of Medicaid that is out there. The one-third of our population that has private insurance is cost-shifted with a huge hit for the underfunding of hospitals, doctors, and other health care providers that goes on with the state program called Medicaid, and, for that matter, the Medicare program, the federal program, also doesn't pay the true cost of providing the health care that they offer. And so the private sector gets a hidden tax by this cost shifting that goes on, has been going on for years. But there is a part of the Affordable Care Act that I mentioned earlier that provides subsidies for folks in the 100 to up to 400% of poverty level when they buy private insurance. And I think that's a good aspect of the Affordable Care Act, frankly.
We're going to go to John Treen in just a moment, but it was 25 years ago that Mr. Treen, the brother of the former Governor David Treen, lost a 227-vote race to David Duke in District 81, which was right next door to Jim Donilon's district, where I think Mr. Duke was actually living. You recall that race, I'm sure.
I recall it well. John is a longtime friend, and I was very active in his campaign, and in fact was at a Archdiocese-sponsored fundraiser at the Roosevelt Hotel on that Saturday night when I called John at his headquarters, and he said, "You'll never guess what happened the night of the first primary. We were expecting a runoff with a then school board member named Delton Charles," and he said, "We're in a runoff with David Duke." And my exact reply to him was, "Then, John, strap on your helmet and get ready for the ride of your life." And for the next 6 weeks, at that time we still had six-week runoff periods, we had media from Germany, from Japan, from all around the world following us, knocking doors in Metairie, Louisiana, in connection with that race. My now deceased friend Shelley Bachop became a major fundraiser for John here in the Baton Rouge area, largely in the Jewish community, because of the fear of neo-Nazis that David Duke represented at that time.
And the circus continued when Mr. Duke arrived in Baton Rouge. As I recall, you were the only member of the Jefferson delegation to vote against seating him.
Yeah, and the motion that Donnie Baquet of Lafayette actually made was to send the issue of his residency to a committee for examination, and I voted for that, as you just mentioned. But it was defeated overwhelmingly. He was seated, served for, I think, 4 years, got cash contributions in the mail at the clerk's office every day from all around the world, and it was a ride beyond what I had anticipated, even when I gave that warning to John as we went into that runoff campaign.
And people forget that he got in a runoff for governor. He got a majority of the white votes, as he did in his race for the U.S. Senate. On primary night back in 91, October 19th, 91, he was just a few percentage points behind Edwin Edwards. He was a threat to be governor of Louisiana.
Yeah, I'm not sure just how close it was, but I defer to your greater knowledge. But you have it?
I do. On primary night, 1991, Edwin Edwards, well...
didn't he run against Bennett Johnston also?
He did. Edwin Edwards got 523,096 votes and Duke 491,342 in the primary. Heavy turnout. And Buddy Romer, 410,690.
Wow.
We'll return with John Treen. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. We switch gears just a bit. We're joined by veteran Republican politico John Treen of Jefferson Parish, and it is that area that has produced a bevy of Louisiana politicos over the last generation or two, including the preceding guest, Jim Donilon. But John Treen, 25 years ago today, was in a primary for the Louisiana House of Representatives, a special election to fill a seat left vacant by Chuck Cusimano, who became a judge. And John Treen and David Duke ended up in a runoff, and Mr. Duke became a national political figure of some repute. John Treen, I'm sure you remember those days quite vividly, even though a quarter century has passed.
I certainly do. I remember them very well and with a lot of regret. But it was very close and it was very interesting, and there were a lot of factors in there that the public wasn't even aware of.
People say, how in the world could you lose a race to David Duke?
Well, let me tell you how it happened. The Monday before the election, the polls, we had a poll showing that I had 60% of the vote.
somehow or other, that information got to the Duke campaign. They said, in desperation, they said, David Duke said that I had been arrested twice, and that if they would call his headquarters, he would tell people why. So people did call the headquarters to find out why I was arrested twice, and by the way, it was a lie, and he admitted it later. And he told them that I had been arrested for DWI, which wasn't true, and for another crime, which I don't want to even discuss. And they spread that information throughout the district. The result was that I lost by just a handful of votes. And 3 months after that election, Duke admitted on a radio program that it was not true. In fact, what he did is they lied in order to win the election and to damage me and cause a great deal of embarrassment to myself and to my family. And some people still are not aware of the fact that Duke admitted it was not true, but it wasn't true. That was one major factor. Another factor was that David Vitter had moved into the district from Orleans Parish and wanted to get involved in politics, so I invited him to come and take part in the campaign and to be sit in on our strategy sessions so that he could, you know, learn a lot, build his campaign, build his future. So he did. Well, what happened is I found out right after the election that he had asked friends of his to vote for David Duke, and when they asked him why, he said, because I want that seat, and I know that Duke won't be there long. So those two factors. So what happened is, I thought it was pretty hypocritical of Vitter to do something like that, to be sitting in on my campaign strategy sessions and be publicly saying he supported me and then asking his friends to vote for Duke. I thought it was pretty hypocritical.
But he never told you that, though, John, did he?
No, he didn't. No, he didn't. He's not going to admit to that. But people have said that he did that.
Well, why do you think it's true?
Because there's more than one person.
Okay. Well, that was 25
years
ago.
So anyway, but that's, I can't, you know, those are the two factors, but the main factor was the fact that Duke slandered me horribly. And by the way, in that election, I carried every precinct that had majority Republican registered voters. What happened is, and this is interesting, Duke had run as a Democrat for office twice previously. And in this particular election, he won by getting the Democrat votes. He carried a number of the Democrat precincts. I carried every single precinct that was majority Republican. So it was a close race. It was an interesting campaign, and there was a lot of attention focused on it, which I didn't really like particularly from out of state. But it gave Louisiana a bad it wasn't good for our reputation, quite frankly, because it sounded like that Louisiana was, you know, was still in the throes of racism and that sort of thing. Because David Duke was a racist, but he primarily was anti-Jewish, more so than anti-black, but he was anti-black as well. But he was definitely made no bones about the fact, and he used to celebrate Adolf Hitler's birthday, and he was a great fan of Adolf Hitler. There's pictures of him and giving talks and so forth about Nazism. So he was a fan of that. His father was from Germany, actually, and that may be the reason why.
Well, his father also was a U.S. military veteran, so I don't know that we can...
No, sir. That is not correct. He served as I think if you check that back, you'll find out that is not correct. But anyway, that's another story. It doesn't really matter. But anyway, that's what happened, and the race was close. And, of course, I was devastated by it because I'd worked very hard, spent money, and the poll showed I was way ahead, and I was, until they spread these lies about me. And, you know, to get beat an election by someone lying about you is really, that really hurts. If it had been a fair election and it had been just based on our campaigns and I'd lost, I wouldn't have felt as bad. But since it was lied about, and that's what caused me to lose, that really got me. But it's over now, and Duke went on. You know, he spent time in jail, and he obviously was not. And Jim Donlan's talking about all the money he was getting. He used to open his envelopes and sitting in the state legislature with cash being given to him. I seriously doubt that that money probably went into his personal expenditures, is my guess. You know, and recently he was in Iran, and about 2 or 3 years ago in Iran, and they of course are anti-Jewish there in Iran, and he was there and declared that the Holocaust didn't happen, and of course we know factually it did happen, but his anti-Jewish stance was. Wasn't particularly popular. That's not what made him popular, I don't think. I think it was his belief in segregation, and you know, he wanted to give certain states to the and move all the black people in the United States into certain states in the Deep South.
Okay, well that was 1989,
and 89. Yeah, that's a long time ago.
I think the most revealing thing you just stated was that there you were. Strategizing against David Duke, and at the table was 27-year-old David Vitter. Did you know then that he had political aspirations?
Yes. Yes, we knew he wanted to get involved in politics and run for office. We knew that, so we invited him. I invited him to come and you know and take part and to learn some things, and he did. He could come to the strategy sessions and so forth, and but that's what happened. But anyway. That's long gone. It's 25 years ago, and David Duke is no longer in the picture, and I'm still around working in the Republican Party. So,
yeah. What is your position now with the Republican Party, John?
I'm a member of the Jefferson Parish Political Parish Executive Committee.
And a former member of the State Central Committee, correct?
Yes. I served 9 terms on the State Central Committee, and I've served 14 terms. I think it's 14. 14 terms on the parish. This is my 14th term in the parish executive committee. I go back to about around 1950.
So you're in Jefferson Parish, as I stated, the area that's produced a bevy of politicos, including Bobby Jindal, for that matter, and Steve Scalise, and Jim Donilon, and others, including
David Vitter. Jefferson, by the way, has 92% of the elected officials in East Jefferson are Republican. That's by far the highest in the state of Louisiana.
Well, yeah, what is the take about David Vitter getting in the governor's race in his own backyard? I suspect you don't live that far away from him when he's in Metairie.
No. I don't know exactly where he lives, but it can't be far away. What is my take on it?
Yes, sir.
Well, I'm supporting Jay Darden. I want to make a point that I think is very valid. Being governor of Louisiana is an executive position. And to elect someone to be governor of a state who has no executive experience is a mistake, because executive experience is only being a successful executive is only gained through experience. This is one of the problems we have with Obama. He had no executive experience. But David Vitter has legal experience and legislative experience, but he has absolutely no executive experiences in his entire life. And to make him chief executive of the state of Louisiana, I think, is a bad mistake. We need people with executive experience. Jay Darden has executive experience, for example, a good bit of it. And he ran the Secretary of State's office. He's run the Lieutenant Governor's office. And he also has legislative experience. So I think that, if General Motors or General Electric picked somebody to be president, chief executive officer with no executive experience, their stock would go to zero. And for us to pick someone with no executive experience to be governor of Louisiana, I think is a serious mistake. Just because they don't have the experience and knowledge to do it.
Well, how much of your opposition to David Vitter is related to the campaign of 89, and you claim that he...
Not much.
Okay.
My opposition is primarily because when he ran against my brother
in 99,
they ran for Congress. They had a meeting at David Vitter's request, and they agreed they would not use negative campaigning against each other. and David Vitter did it in the last week of the campaign. And by the way, David Vitter arranged to have Duke people, Duke, support him. And my brother would not. This woman, Wendy Cortez, who's a hooker, came to our office and told us about David Vitter visiting her on a regular basis. She's a paid prostitute. And it's come out, that has come out in the past. In fact, she passed a lie detector test about that. And you know, I don't think that this is the right thing to do in Louisiana, is to have a somewhat of no executive experience. And I think that Jay Jordan would be a far better choice. But that's my choice. That's my opinion, and that's based on not just on what's happened in the past. It's based on what I think is adequate experience and the ability to get along with people. And when Vitter was in the state legislature, the legislators told me he was the most unpopular legislator in the history of Louisiana, and he's not popular in Washington, D.C. with the Senate. What happens is the people he deals with don't seem to care for him at all. The people that don't know him like him a lot.
Well, how does he win elections, John?
Because most of the people really don't know him. You know, what they see is just the image. But the people that, if you go back and check with the legislators, who are in the legislature with him in Louisiana, and check with the people in the Senate, they'll tell you that, no, they don't care for the guy. They don't like him. He's hard to deal with. But anyway, that's another story. It had nothing to do with Duke. But Duke was quite a figure here, and he raised a great deal of money across the country, from all over the world and across the country, because of his stance on racism and his anti-Semitic views. And that has become less and less of an issue. But as you recall, back in 1989, that was 25 years ago, that was closer to the time of desegregation of schools and so forth, and there were a lot of people still upset about that. Nowadays, it's not as big an issue by a long shot. That's a plus for us.
Well, yesterday on this show, I stated that I thought that unless there is new information about Senator Vitter, that this allegation of the prostitution, allegation which I'm sure was true in 2007, that it's a seven-year-old story. Let's move on. Let's talk about other things unless there's something new. Would you agree with that?
Not entirely. I think that a person's personal history and also their public as a public official is always good because it's a reflection of their character. And I think that if it's something that happened once many years ago, that would be one thing. But this wasn't once. He admitted it, and he used a Chicago madam, the Canal Street madam, said that he was a customer. This Wendy Cortez woman that came here and our campaign at Dave's campaign headquarters said it was there. Said she was.
Well, you brought that up twice with this Wendy Cortez, who was interviewed by the Picayune 7 years ago. Did she visit directly with David Treen?
No. She came to the party headquarters and talked to me and a couple other people there.
So she talked directly to you?
Yes.
And why do you believe her?
Because I think it would be very difficult for someone to go to the trouble of coming to see us just to make up a story like that.
Was she asking for anything in return?
Nothing. She wanted nothing. She just said she was really upset because he was trying to pass himself off as a highly moral person, and look what he was doing. So that was her attitude. So okay. I can't speak for all of her motivations. I'm just telling you what happened.
Do you think Vitter will win?
I don't know. I think that things will come out about him that may hurt him. I don't know that he's going to win or not. I think that he has some baggage, and I think some more will probably be exposed. Now, whether that was keeping him from winning, I really don't know.
Well, John Treen, we thank you. Certainly look forward to talking with you sometime soon.
I think Jay Jordan is very popular with elected officials in this state.
John Treen, thank you, and happy 88th birthday in a few days. And we'll be
2 weeks from today. I'll be 88.
We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.